On November 25th, Duane Logue sent Ron a letter requesting an appointment on December 4th. Logue said, in part, "I am concerned about your well-being, and I hope to see you then." On December 4th, Juanita informed Mental Health Services that Ron had a job and was living in Ardmore. He had met some new friends, had become involved with a church, had accepted Christ again, and no longer needed the help of the Mental Health Service. His case was closed. It was reopened 10 days later when he was seen again by Duane Logue. Ron needed long-term treatment, but he would not agree to it, nor would he consistently take the prescribed medications, primarily lithium. At times, he would freely admit to abusive drinking and drug use. Then he would adamantly deny it. "Just a few beers," he would say, if asked how much. Since he couldn't keep a job, he was always broke. When Juanita refused to loan him money, he would roam around Ada, looking for another source. Not surprisingly, his circle of friends was shrinking. Most people avoided him. Several times he drove to Asher, where he could always find Merle Bowen at the baseball field. They'd chat, Ron would deliver another hard luck tale, and his old coach would fork over another $20. While Ron was promising to pay it back, Merle was delivering a stern lecture about cleaning up his life. Ron's refuge was Bruce Leba, who had remarried and was living a much quieter life in his home a few miles out of town. About twice a month, Ron would stagger up to the door, drunk and disheveled, and beg Bruce to give him a place to sleep. Bruce always took him in, sobered him up, fed him, and usually loaned him $10. In February 1981, Ron was again arrested for drunk driving and pleaded guilty. After a few days in jail, he went to Chickasha to see his sister Renee and her husband Gary. They found him in their backyard one Sunday when they returned from church. He explained that he had been living in a tent behind their rear fence, and he certainly looked the part. Further, he had just escaped from some army men down the road in Lawton, and these soldiers had stashed weapons and explosives in their homes and were planning to overthrow the base. Luckily, he had escaped in time and now needed a place to live. Renee and Gary allowed him to stay in their son's bedroom. Gary found him a job on a farm hauling hay, a gig that lasted 2 days before he quit because he said he'd found a softball team that needed him. The farmer later called and told Gary that Ron was not welcome back and that, in his opinion, he had some serious emotional problems. Ron's interest in American presidents was suddenly rekindled, and for days he talked of nothing else. Not only could he quickly name them in order and reverse order, but he knew everything about them. Birth dates, birthplaces, terms, vice presidents, wives and children, administration highlights, and so on. Every conversation around the Simmonses' home had to center on an American president. Nothing else could be discussed as long as Ron was present. He was thoroughly nocturnal. Though he was willing to sleep at night, he was incapable of doing so. Plus, he enjoyed all-night television at full volume. With the first rays of sunlight, he became drowsy and drifted away. The Simmonses, tired and red-eyed, enjoyed a quiet breakfast before going off to work. He often complained of headaches. Gary heard noises one night and found Ron sorting through the medicine cabinet, looking for something to deaden the pain. When the nerves had frayed enough, Gary sat Ron down for the inevitable serious chat. Gary explained that Ron was welcome to stay, but he had to adjust to their schedule. Ron showed no signs of understanding that he had problems. He left quietly and returned to his mother's, where he was either comatose on the sofa or holed up in his apartment, 28 years old and unable to admit that he needed help.